Hello and welcome to Background Briefing, available 24/7 at backgroundbriefing.org. I'm Ian Masters, and today we'll look into a number of stories and issues in the news. We'll begin with today's Supreme Court hearing on Trump's immunity claim that is delaying Jack Smith's Washington, D.C. case against Trump for the January 6th insurrection. And based on what we heard today, the far-right justices will delay things even more until after the election, or possibly rule in favor of presidents having immunity to commit crimes in and out of office. Joining us is Aziz Huq, a professor of law at the University of Chicago, who is a former clerk for Supreme Court Justice Ruth Bader Ginsburg, and is the co-author of How to Save a Constitutional Democracy, and his latest book is The Collapse of Constitutional Remedies. He had an article at Politico back at the end of February, Why is Trump Getting Special Treatment from the Supreme Court? Then we will assess the implications of the TikTok ban President Biden signed, not just in terms of possible influence China has over millions of young American users, but how the social media platform relates to the broader problem of surveillance capitalism, which is the business model for Facebook, Google, and other American tech giants. Joining us is Ann Kokas, a professor of media studies at the University of Virginia, whose research examines Sino-US media and technology relations. She is the author of Hollywood Made in China, and most recently, Trafficking Data, How China is Winning the Battle for Digital Sovereignty, and we will discuss her article at the Los Angeles Times, Why a TikTok Ban Isn't What We Need. Then finally, we'll speak with David Austin Walsh, a postdoctoral fellow at the Yale Program for the Study of Antisemitism and a college fellow at the University of Virginia. He's the author of the new book, Just Out, Taking America Back, The Conservative Movement and the Far Right, and we'll discuss antisemitism on campuses and the enduring relationship between America's far right and conservative movements of responsible and respectable Republicans. And before we begin, I would like to thank our listener donors who keep Background Briefing independent, corporate, and commercial free without paywalls or constant fundraising by making tax-deductible donations to our nonprofit foundation, the Public Truth Media Foundation, at publictruthmedia.org or at backgroundbriefing.org/donate. As we enter this fact-free and violence-prone election year, with much of the country under the cult-like spell of a deranged demagogue spewing constant lies while inciting hatred and violence, help us continue to seek out facts and information to awaken America's silent majority before our democracy is trumped by fascism. And joining us now is Aziz Huq, who's a professor of law at the University of Chicago. He's a former clerk for Supreme Court Justice Ruth Bader Ginsburg and is the co-author of Unchecked and Unbalanced, Presidential Power in a Time of Terror, and How to Save a Constitutional Democracy. And his latest book is The Collapse of Constitutional Remedies. And he had an article at Politico back at the end of February, Why is Trump Getting Special Treatment from the Supreme Court? Welcome to Background Briefing, Aziz Huq.
Great to be here, Ian.
Well, thanks for joining us, Aziz. And back in February, you had an article at Politico, Why is Trump Getting Special Treatment from the Supreme Court? And in today's oral arguments, there's no question that many of the conservative or far-right justices, depending on how you want to characterize them, were very sympathetic, particularly Alito and, of course, Gorsuch as well. But you're more or less, in your earlier article, talking about a double standard here. So does that double standard still apply, given that the justices have sanctioned people, particularly in death penalty cases, for dragging things out, when in fact the whole strategy of Donald Trump is to drag things out, and the Supreme Court appears to be cooperating and helping him in that regard?
I think there's two double standards at work. The first is a timing double standard, where the court has bent over backward to facilitate litigation brought by Trump to enable his access to the ballot. And it has slow-walked litigation brought by prosecutors challenging Trump's actions in and around the January 6th violence, seeking accountability for those criminal acts before the election. So what the court has done by putting the case on the argument schedule for April in a way that guarantees that a ruling will not happen before at best late June and probably the end of at best late May and probably the end of June, is that it will be extremely hard for a criminal trial to unfold in DC in the wake of this oral argument. So the court has already stacked the deck through timing in Donald Trump's favor. The second double standard was evident in the proceedings, the oral argument today. For example, in most criminal law cases, the court embraces what it calls a presumption of regularity about the operation of the criminal justice scheme. Where the government's lawyer, Mike Dreeben, today pointed to safeguards in the criminal justice system to prevent improper prosecution, such as the grand jury system, conservative justices such as Justice Alito mocked those safeguards. So the criminal justice system is seen, is deemed regular and presumptively in good shape when there are defendants the court doesn't like, and it's deemed as being deeply flawed when it's a defendant that the court likes. Similarly, Justice Alito made the extraordinary point, or made the extraordinary argument, that the court should decide this case as if the threat to an election came, or the threat to democracy came not because a sitting president tried to suborn the electoral process. The court should imagine that exactly the opposite had occurred, and that a sitting president had been subject to a prosecution that derailed the peaceful transfer of power. The court suggested, Alito suggested the court should decide, in effect, an imaginary scenario that flipped the equities in a way that benefited Trump and resolved the case based upon not real world facts, but a scenario purely of the justices imagining that would result in plainly Trump winning.
But Aziz, the Court of Appeals decision seemed to be so clear, and I don't understand why the Supreme Court took up this case. Most, and a lot of legal scholars have asked that question. Why did they take it up? Because as you recall, in the decision by, I think it was Judge Pan, asked the Trump lawyer, saying, are you saying that Trump needs immunity, which would give him the right to have SEAL Team 6 assassinate his political rival? And the lawyer was forced to say yes. I would have thought that would have ended it.
And I think if the... This is not an instance in which there is a basis in what the court calls original understandings or text or history that favors Trump. The arguments that we heard from the conservative justices all focus upon consequences. And what's remarkable is how selective and myopic they are in those in their framing and understanding of those consequences. I think that what we heard today was an illustration of how the justices can cherry pick and distort arguments in ways that undermine and threaten the persistence of democratic norms.
So if we won't hear anything until the end of June, and I mean, has anybody today suggested that the American people deserve to know everything about a candidate running for president? And if you can't have a trial about what most people see as one of the greatest assaults on American democracy in its history, and not since the British burned the White House, has anything happened like the attack on the Capitol itself? That's a major event. Even the Supreme Court justices must have noticed it and watched the video. I mean, we're being denied an accounting about what happened and who was responsible for it. And a lot of the evidence points at Trump himself.
Well, it's worth recalling that this is not something that all of the justices were merely bystanders to. Recall that there is credible evidence that Justice Thomas's wife, Ginny Thomas, was in telephonic communication with people who were involved in the insurgency on January 6th. So I think the matter is actually a little worse than the way you just framed it.
Well, but it never came up today, did it? They avoided talking about the January 6th case itself.
Circumvention is, I think it speaks for itself with respect to the justice's willingness to perceive the actual threats to American democracy and to hypothesize, to imagine, to conjure unreal threats as a way of avoiding the subject of what in fact has happened.
So in other words, are they just being political operatives in robes? Are they not concerned about being so politically biased, which would seem to be the case?
Well, it's hard to know what the justices perceive or how they understand their own actions, but certainly I think it's very hard to come away from the oral arguments in this case without an impression that selectivity and cherry-picking over arguments is occurring in a way that is plainly partisan.
And is there any sense that somebody might be peeled off? I mean, in the abortion case, the Idaho abortion case, where they may well undermine the Reagan-era law that means that hospitals have to accept emergency cases even if they can't pay, there was some indication that Amy Coney Barrett and the Chief Justice John Roberts may side with the three liberal judges, but was there any indication today?
I would need to go back and read the transcript before making a judgment of that kind. I will say that many of the questions focused upon the gap or the distinction between official and unofficial actions, and the government lawyer conceded that there are some actions that cannot be the basis of prosecution taken by a president, and that probably was a wise concession that is consistent with the ruling from the D.C. Circuit. I think that there's a range of opinions that can be imagined based upon the oral argument today that leave open pathways for accountability, both in general and in the case of Trump.
So is there basically, is this all about the fact that January the 6th happened when Trump was president and now he's not president, but he's running for the president? What's the distinction between being a president, and we know about the OLC rule, which is not a law, which says you can't indict a sitting president, but after they leave the presidency, they're fair game, aren't they?
Well, that's the issue before the court. I think that's the question before the court.
Right.
I don't think anyone thinks that a sitting president would ever be indicted, because a sitting president controls or exercises a great deal of sway over the Justice Department. So this question of presidential immunity arises with respect to presidents who've left office. Right. So that's the fact pattern that is before the court, but it is also the fact pattern that I think is plausibly the one that is of practical importance.
So what would be then the consequences of this court ruling in Trump's favor and giving him immunity and future presidents immunity?
I think if you had a broad ruling that said any action, it doesn't sound as if there would be a broad ruling that says any action, whether it's official or unofficial, would receive immunity. Even Kavanaugh's comments suggested there's a distinction between official and unofficial actions. And so everything turns upon how one understands what the scope of official actions are, and in particular, whether official actions can be used as evidence in a case which is otherwise focused upon unofficial actions. So I don't think it's a binary. I think there's the devil will be in the details, and there's a range of different ways in which the outcome could be described here, which have quite different effects, and it's hard to know in advance which direction we're going in.
But just in closing, Justice Gorsuch said that this case is one for the ages. So he's saying that he's framing this case as being important for posterity. Why is that? Why, I mean, given the skepticism about taking the case in the first place, what's it? In other words, if it ain't broke, you don't need to fix it.
I think he read generously, I think it's clear that I think he's it's certainly true that these are the first instances in which a president has been criminally prosecuted in the wake of leaving office for something that was done in and around his office holding. And under any circumstances, or even just given that fact, the case is pathbreaking, is an utterly novel set of issues. So just on that basis, what Gorsuch said is probably accurate, regardless of how the court comes out at the end of the day.
Well, Aziz Haq, I thank you very much for joining us here today.
Thanks, Ian.
And I've just been speaking with Aziz Haq, who's a professor of law at the University of Chicago. He's a former clerk for Supreme Court Justice Ruth Bader Ginsburg, and is the co-author of Unchecked and Unbalanced, Presidential Power in a Time of Terror, and How to Save a Constitutional Democracy. And his latest book is The Collapse of Constitutional Remedies. And he had an article back at the end of February at Politico, Why is Trump Getting Special Treatment from the Supreme Court? We can take a brief station break and back with an assessment of the implications from the TikTok ban President Biden just signed. You know I am no stranger, I know rules are a bore, but just to keep you from danger, I am the law. Welcome back. I'm Ian Masters, and this is Background Briefing, available 24/7 at backgroundbriefing.org. And joining us now is Ann Kokas, a professor of media studies at the University of Virginia, whose research examines Sino-U.S. media and technology relations. She is the author of Hollywood Made in China, and most recently, Trafficking Data, How China is Winning the Battle for Digital Sovereignty. And she has an article at the Los Angeles Times, Why a TikTok Ban Isn't What We Need. Welcome to Background Briefing, Ann Kokas.
Thank you so much for having me. It's a pleasure to be here.
Well, thanks, Anne. And obviously, Biden sort of was forced, I guess, into signing this bill in order to get aid to Ukraine, Taiwan, and to Israel. But your sense is, I take it, is that it's going to have some pretty detrimental consequences. So what is the worst aspect of it?
Well, I think actually it's not that it makes a great deal of sense for TikTok to continue operating in the US. There are significant problems with the firm. And we just saw recently that ByteDance has said that they will most likely, they're more likely to shut down their TikTok operations in the US than they would be to actually sell the app, which I think is indicative of certain concerns that the company has about disclosing its core algorithm with US firms. But one of the things that we can see is that this is in some ways a red herring focusing on one specific company rather than the larger weaknesses of the U.S. data ecosystem.
So I was interested to learn from your article, the Los Angeles Times, that in spite of the fact that China has this ubiquitous surveillance system on its citizens, it nevertheless protects consumer data from corporations, which is, I guess, what's referred to as surveillance capitalism. So explain that further, if you will.
So in many ways, China is more aligned with the European Union and with Japan, our democratic allies, than the US is with respect to personal data protection from corporate data exploitation. Now, obviously, as we've discussed in a lot of different contexts, the Chinese government does gather huge amounts of data from its citizens through government entities and through the pressure that the Chinese government is able to place on corporations. But corporations have more constrained data gathering on individuals than they do in a US context. Now, the reason that this is important is because, number one, it makes it quite difficult for the US to actually be able to critique China on its corporate data gathering policies related to citizens when we're talking in an international context. The other part that I think is really important is that it in many ways shows how backward the US data governance landscape is, the ways in which companies can gather huge amounts of user data from individuals with very, very few constraints. And how this is actually not a global norm or a global standard, but really reflective of the exploitative environment of the US tech landscape.
So, just to touch on ByteDance and what you think might happen to TikTok, how long have they got? A year, have they, before the hammer comes down on a forced sale?
Yeah, so my understanding is that there's a year, and it's not a forced sale, it's a year to sell, at which point the US government would shut TikTok down.
And their response is what? To just pull out?
So what we've seen so far is a mad rush of US companies interested in purchasing this property. And ByteDance saying that they're more than likely going to focus on shutting it down.
So the biggest shareholder, of course, in TikTok in the United States is Jeffrey Yass, a billionaire who's the biggest donor to the Republican Party. And Donald Trump was trashing TikTok along with many Republican congresspeople. But after meeting with Jeff Yass, he changed his tune and said that TikTok was great and shouldn't be shut down. So what are the politics going on here? Do you know?
Well, clearly there are some clearly this flip-flop on Trump's part related to TikTok has at least su is at least suggestive of the influence of the Republican donor class. But one of the things I think that's worth noting is even though this is congressional action and likely would remain in place if there was a change in presidency, that the election does necessarily complicate this entire transaction and what will happen moving forward. Now, one of the key differences is Trump's action on TikTok, that his TikTok ban actually was through an executive order rather than through congressional legislation, which is much easier for a president to change. And we saw that the Biden administration issued a new executive order, which counteracted the previous Trump executive order. And so while this congressional action is much stickier, much more permanent, would likely persist, there are ways that the president can also shape things around the margins, as it would relate to a potential ban or not.
But my understanding is that the concern from the intelligence community is that China has access to the data on millions and millions of Americans and could perhaps manipulate the minds of young Americans. And there were suggestions, for example, recently that the objection that young Americans have to the war in Gaza might have been, to some extent, influenced by TikTok. None of that stuff sounds particularly solid in terms of. I mean, what is the intelligence community holding back if indeed there's some serious concerns? Because so far, it doesn't seem like they've really made a strong case.
Right. Well, I mean, there's a I couldn't disclose to you what the intelligence community was holding back. That's not something that we would be talking about here. But I think we can think about several different scenarios. So one would be elevating certain types of discourse over others, which essentially would, as you point out in the Gaza case, lead to social destabilization in a US context. And indeed, we've actually seen that. So I would actually push back against your claim that an elevation of discourse about pro-Gaza discourse in among young Americans is not having a political effect. In fact, I think it's having a really significant one. And kind of regardless of one's politics on the issue, what we can see is that it's leading to a potential demographic shift in voters of, who are a key Biden demographic. The other thing that I think is important to note is that this process of elevating certain types of discourse over other types of discourse, in order to move politics in one direction or another, is a type of election interference or election influencing that we've seen, for hundreds of years. Since the beginning of the founding of the United States, where there was concern about the influence of the French in US elections. So this isn't necessarily something new. However, the thing that's new is the ubiquity and the targeting, the micro targeting of apps like TikTok.
Well, but and Cocos, is that to say that China is manipulating the minds of young Americans? I thought the kids were basically figuring it out for themselves about what's happening in Gaza just from the broad media landscape, that they're appalled at what's happening.
Right. And I think that that's, I mean, it's one thing that's important to note here is there is what's happening in Gaza, which is deeply troubling. And I was just talking with some of my students about this, something that while, you know, there have been persistent challenges in this part of the Middle East for, you know, millennia, this is a moment where a lot of young people in America are kind of first waking up to this crisis. And it's profoundly unsettling. And in no way do I mean to mitigate or diminish the power of these protests or of this moment. And at the same time, I think we need to recognize that it's unclear how the TikTok algorithm is operating to elevate certain types of discourse and suppress other types of discourse. And it is very suggestive that certain types of discourse, certain types of political discourse may be elevated.
So, as long as the algorithm is secret, we don't really know the extent to which the manipulation by the Chinese Communist Party is really a clear and present danger.
Well, there are a lot of things we don't know. So, first of all, we don't know the degree to which ByteDance is facing pressure from the Chinese Communist Party. So ByteDance argues that it's very minimal, but what we've seen in other companies is that's not necessarily the case. We don't know precisely how the TikTok algorithm is manipulating information and manipulating users. Though we do know from other social media companies that social media algorithms do elevate certain types of content and suppress certain types of content and micro-target and try to identify the types of content that most elevate users' concerns and their anxieties. And that is well-documented research. So the question is, when we combine all of these things, what does that mean for TikTok's operations? And I think the key point to note here is that rather than trying to capitalize off of TikTok's operations by thinking about selling them, we see ByteDance talking about shutting it down. And granted, it's currently a loss-making enterprise, but it's also suggestive of a kind of protection of TikTok's core algorithm over any potential long-term business in the US.
So the fact that one of the complaints has been about the data storage and whether or not China ends up with massive amounts of data on American citizens, I thought that ByteDance had offered to have the data stored here. I think they were going to use one of the big U.S. tech companies. What do you know about them?
Yeah, so there's Oracle's
Oracle, yeah.
Project Texas, which would store user data in Texas and would not, so there would be something called data localization. So all user data would be essentially stored in the US. The key point here, though, is that the algorithm, which is what feeds people information and allows for micro-targeting, would not actually be located within the US.
I see. So that's the, so there is a problem. I mean,
Right.
it's not as if the intelligence community is hyperventilating.
So as someone who's lived in China and has been subject to a lot of different types of oversight there, I would want to mitigate to the degree possible the power that the Chinese government has over firms operating in the US and gathering data here.
So this is just goes beyond the idea. For example, Rupert Murdoch, who's an Australian, he became an American citizen in order to buy and control media over here. This is not about foreign media ownership, this issue. This is a national security issue as opposed to an issue over foreign ownership of media assets.
Well, and I think one could make the argument that, you know, Rupert Murdoch's decision to become an American citizen reflects a certain skepticism about foreign ownership of major media platforms in the US. But yes, I think we can, so TikTok's operations in a US context go far beyond just the dissemination of information. It's more about how information can be generated, how it can be distributed, how it can be targeted, and also what that means about what the app can gather about individuals when they're responding to that type of information. So it's not just that I receive a video, it's how long I watch it, how I re how if I share it, if I click on it, if I create content based upon it. So those are that's a type of information that is possible to gather about individuals that doesn't exist when you're, for example, just disseminating news on television.
So India banned TikTok, did they not? I mean, obviously, there's a India and China have something of a strategic rivalry, and they've had some border disputes in the Himalayas. What were the consequences there? Were there any backlash from young Indian users?
I think the key point is that the Indian bans occurred much earlier, in 2020. They also occurred at a time when there had recently been territorial skirmishes between China and India. And so there was much less backlash at that point, first of all, because TikTok was less ubiquitous, but also because in some ways it was seen domestically as a response to China's sovereign overreach into India.
So then, what do you think will be the political consequences? We mentioned how the Biden administration is already in having problems with young Americans, not to mention Arab Americans in Michigan, a key swing state, but young Americans dissatisfied with Biden's approach to Netanyahu and the war in Gaza. This would compound it, would it not, a TikTok ban, because it's very popular, is it not? I mean, it's no amount of endorsements from Taylor Swift would overcome that kind of annoyance on the part of young Americans.
Well, I think that it's important to note that in some ways this tends to it's we don't know exactly what the implications of this will be. How long, like, will ByteDance shut it down? Will they decide to sell it? It seems like they'll probably shut it down, but also how long would that take? So the policy pronouncement of a ban is happening in April of 2024. A lot can happen before November. And if there isn't actually a change in how the app operates, then it's really hard to know how that will impact young Americans, or other demographics that are particularly affected by the strife in Gaza. The key point here, I think, is that because Biden signed a TikTok ban, it's difficult for him to use TikTok for campaigning at this point.
Well, that's shooting yourself in the foot, isn't it?
Yeah, so in some ways, so there had been actually pressure from Democratic activists to slow roll this until after the election so that Biden could still use the platform to be able to promote his policy points. So this is an interesting challenge that I think has emerged as well for the 2024 election.
So, just in closing, then, Anne, is there any chance that TikTok could change the algorithm and make it less manipulative in terms of political bias?
I mean, I think that this is a bigger question about all social media apps, and there's very little incentive to create apps that do anything other than draw on the kind of most hyperbolic emotions, because that leads to engagement. And so it's not, in that case, it's not just about TikTok, it's about all social media and the ways in which it generates attention and revenue.
Right. Shedding heat but no light.
Right, exactly.
I thank you for joining us, Anne. I appreciate it.
Thank you so much. Have a great day.
You too. And again, I've been speaking with Anne Coccus, who's a professor of media studies at the University of Virginia, whose research examines Sino-US media. She's the author of Hollywood Made in China and most recently, Trafficking Data, How China is Winning the Battle for Digital Sovereignty. And she has an article at the Los Angeles Times, Why a TikTok Ban Isn't What We Need. We're going to take a brief station break. We're back discussing anti-Semitism on campuses and the enduring relationship between America's far right and conservative movements of responsible and respectable Republicans.
Digging away.
Welcome back. I'm Ian Masters, and this is Background Briefing, available 24/7 at backgroundbriefing.org. And joining us now are David Austin Walsh, a postdoctoral associate at the Yale Program for the Study of Antisemitism and a college fellow at the University of Virginia. He's the author of the new book, just out, Taking America Back, The Conservative Movement and the Far Right. Welcome to Background Briefing, David Austin Walsh.
Thank you for having me, Ian.
Thanks for joining us, David. And it would seem that at the moment, the far right is driving the conservative movement in as much as Donald Trump and the Freedom Caucus. I mean, just look at what happened over aid to Ukraine. It was held up successfully for months by a handful of far right Republicans in the House. And similarly, it would seem to me, if you go back to the 50s, after the incredible success of the New Deal and of Roosevelt, America had some sort of vestige, if you will, of social democracy. The Democrats were totally dominant. And then along comes Joe McCarthy and Roy Cohn, who happens to be the mentor of Donald Trump. They hoist this canard of paranoia that anybody who's progressive in domestic politics is therefore aiding and abetting the Soviet enemy, and shrunk the Democrats down, and the Republicans came back with a vengeance in the 1950s, taking over the presidency, the House, and the Senate. So it seems to me that in many ways the far right has driven the conservative movement in this country. Mm-hmm. Not all the time, but in important eras, and appears to be doing so now.
No, I think that's right. And I think that the, you know, a couple of things about the 1950s here, because in the 1950s, I think unlike in the 2020s, you did have the far right with their, you know, sort of led by Joe McCarthy, although there were many, many others involved, helped to propel the Republican Party to capture the White House with the election of Dwight Eisenhower. But unlike in 2016, 2020, and now in 2024, where you have the far right candidate sort of sailing to the nomination, it wasn't Eisenhower was by no means the first choice of the right or of conservatives writ large in 1952. They preferred Robert Taft, who was a sort of isolationist senator from Ohio. In fact, the reason why Dwight Eisenhower picked Richard Nixon as his vice presidential nominee, Nixon being, you know, he made his reputation as a sort of red baiter and anti-communist in Congress in the late 40s, was to shore up his right flank. Eisenhower wanted to minimize the number of defections or stay-home voters when he went up against Hedley Stevens of all people in 1952. And in fact, it's the sort of clash between the Eisenhower administration and the McCarthy forces that eventually lead to McCarthy's sort of disgrace and censure and downfall in the mid-1950s. But I think it's also important to remember that the modern conservative movement, so, you know, the intellectuals led by William F. Buckley Jr. and activists sort of at the grassroots level, the people who founded the John Birch Society, men like Robert Welch, were all incredibly pro-McCarthy and remain so for the rest of their lives. So I don't think it's an exaggeration to say that, I mean, in my book, I sort of push back the timeline of the sort of foundation of modern conservatism, the modern far right, to the New Deal. It's based in opposition to the New Deal. But in a very real sense, they coalesced into a distinctive movement that would eventually sort of successfully contest political power in the 1960s, 70s, and certainly with Reagan in the 80s, out of the McCarthy moment.
So what's the role then of plutocrats and business types like the character in your book, Merwin Hart, who was a small businessman? You have Welch, the candy manufacturer, backing the John Birch Society.
You'll never be able to eat Junior Mints the same way again when you realize that the guy who founded the John Birch Society invented them.
Exactly. But it seems to me that in many ways, Merwin Hart, his modern counterpart, would be Grover Norquist, who has this organization on the far right that wants to shrink the government down to the point where you can drown it in the bathtub. And he, of course, is getting an awful lot of money from the biggest donor now to the Republican Party, a billionaire called Jeff Yass, who is also funding right-wing pro-Israel causes and putting a lot of money into getting rid of candidates on the Democratic left, progressive candidates that AIPAC have been targeting. So what's the relationship between the far right and American plutocrats? Not all of them, but some of them.
Yeah, no, it's a really good question. And I think that there are, and you just made them there, actually, there are two important distinctions to make, because on the one hand, you have people like Grover Norquist in the modern era. There are others. Merwin Hart back in the 1930s, who was the founder and head of what was called the New York State Economic Council, became the National Economic Council, which is sort of right-wing pro-business lobbying group, also engaged in the unofficial lobbying for the government of Francisco Franco and helped to promulgate a lot of anti-Semitism. But, you know, Merwin Hart was not a plutocrat as such. He was a sort of, he was part of, I think, the national power elite. I think that's fair to say. He, you know, was a relatively wealthy businessman. He had a degree from Harvard. He was personally acquainted with Franklin Roosevelt. They were classmates at Harvard back in the 1890s. But his sort of political base of power stems from his geographic location. He was based in upstate New York. A lot of his clients and friends were mid-sized manufacturers who were, you know, building light electronics, stuff like that, in the Mohawk Valley, in that region. So there's a distinction to be made between people like that and, you know, the billionaires who, I mean, even at the time in the 1930s, some of them certainly were approaching billionaire status. You know, the people who owned or were senior up at General Motors or the Ford Motor Company or what have you. But they're funding a lot of the same causes. They're involved in a lot of the same things. I mean, the American Liberty League, which was a sort of infamous example in the mid-1930s of a group of plutocrats that funded this organization. Hart was peripherally involved, funded this organization to challenge FDR's New Deal. I mean, the money came from senior executives at GM. There's always this relationship between the sort of upper middle class sort of organizers and the big money donors. Another great example of this actually would be Joe McCarthy. So in 1946, Merwin Hart and some other conservative activists come together to found this group called American Action, which is a political action committee. It's actually the first right-wing one in American political history. And they get money from all sorts of different people. One of the big donors in Wisconsin is a real estate developer named Walter Harnischfeger, who was active in Wisconsin Republican politics for years. Strongly opposed American entry into World War II. He was quoted as saying some like more or less unambiguously pro-Nazi things as late as 1943. And he was Joe McCarthy's Daddy Warbucks. He helped fund his 1946 Senate campaign. There is always going to be this connection between plutocrats and these sorts of mid-level organizational entrepreneurs. What I think is distinct in the 21st century is just how much this has accelerated, and how few other options there seem to be for, and this is not just on the right either, alternative models for financing political activism and political campaigns. I mean, the reason I say that American Action was the first right-wing political action committee in the United States is because there was a political action committee before American Action. It was called CIOPAC. It was the CIO's political action committee. So it was the unions that were using these at the time new sort of organizational models to fund political campaigns. We're seeing a revival of I think the best traditions of American trade unionism, certainly in the past 2 or 3 years, and I was thrilled to see the results of the UAW, the recent UAW election in Tennessee. But we still do have a long way to go before that can become a sort of viable, sustainable financing model to sort of counter this billionaire influence.
Your new book, Taking America Back, the Conservative Movement and the Far Right, David Austin Walsh, is very much about William F. Buckley and the notion of respectable or responsible conservatism. Because Buckley, in many ways, was driven, as far as I know, by the fact that his family had vast holdings in oil in Mexico, and when the Mexican government nationalized the oil, they were pretty bitter about it, right? So where does he fit in the pantheon of plutocrats or small business in terms of being either a funder or a proponent of right-wing dogma?
Yeah. No, I mean, Buckley is an interesting figure because he is a sort of in-between person. And I have so many Buckley stories. I could go on for the better part of an hour about all of the interesting things I found in his archive. I'll just share one with you briefly, since we're talking about his family and how they got their money. When he was when he went into the army in World War II, he kept writing letters to his father, who was, again, very wealthy, made all of his money in Mexico in the oil industry, complaining about how nobody in his platoon in officer cadet school seemed to like him. Because he kept talking about how the New Deal was empowering the worst parts of American society, and the rich actually deserve their money by virtue of their superior work ethic and genes and stuff like this. So, you know, he had some very received views about how the role of wealth and privilege in society. So the interesting thing about Buckley is that he had obviously a lot of personal wealth. The Buckley family had a tremendous amount of resources. However, in his various political projects, I mean, most famously National Review Magazine, which he founded in 1955, but there are others, he would have to fundraise. I mean, he wasn't just financing them all out of his own pocket. There was elements of that. But he would be going to people like Merwin Hart, who was a friend of his father's, going to people like Robert Welch, his later rival, who was, the founder of the John Birch Society. Some people who I write about in the book, like Russell McGuire, who had politics that were, even at the time, verging on open fascism, and many of whom embraced them afterwards. And he would hit them up for money. I mean, he asked Robert Welch to help finance the foundation of National Review. So, I mean, there is a sort of porous wall between funders and activists. There are some activists, and Buckley would be an example, who could theoretically self-fund, but they can't self-fund everything. And you see this a lot. I don't really go into this in the book, but I've written in other venues about the sort of tangled network of right-wing philanthropy. This is a part of it too. You have people who are, prominent conservative families who are, throwing gobs of money into like the Scaife Foundation, the Bradley Foundation. All of these, families have their own foundations. One of them alone is not enough to finance, an entire mass political movement. So that's why there's this sort of competitive fundraising space. But there are people who navigate these two different worlds sort of semi-seamlessly, if that makes sense.
Right. Well, I guess an equivalent to some extent of Buckley today would be Leonard Leah, who has got about $1.6 billion to spend on far-right causes. He's already stacked the Supreme Court.
Absolutely, that would be a perfect
and he's sort of Opus Dei, not that Buckley was, but he was definitely driven by his religion, which is why he couldn't handle or be completely on board with some of these far right fascists, some of whom were atheists. But just to touch on the current situation, one of the things I find interesting about the respectable conservatives of the Buckley ilk today are that many of them, like the Lincoln Project, turn out to be the most effective critics of the MAGA Republican movement, much more so than the Democrats. They're the best campaigners for the Democrats. What do you think of that current movement?
Yeah, no, I mean, I'll give you, this is not my sort of like I'm a scholar answer, but I'll give you my sort of, these are my politics, this is my political answer. Yes, on the one hand, I think that the Lincoln Project, even people, as loath as I am to give her any praise whatsoever, but people like Lynn Cheney and Mitt Romney have been attempting to push back against Trumpism and the Republican Party, and have been open to tactical alliances with Democrats and liberals to push back against the most extreme elements of MAGAism. Now, that being said, I think that there are a couple of dangers to this. One is that realistically, and this is sort of a broader point, I don't expand on it too much in the book, but you know, the so-called responsible conservatives, the respectable conservatives from the 60s and 70s, you know, they didn't really have a mass political backing behind them. It's one of the reasons why in the 21st century, their position has, you know, certainly after Trump was elected, but even before then, was becoming increasingly untenable. What Buckley and the others did in the 1960s and 70s was to kind of ride the wave of a lot of agitation, a lot of unrest among conservatives and right wingers in this country to a position of real social, political, and I would even say cultural power, without necessarily reflecting all of the views of the sort of mass movements. They were able to I mean, this is what is essentially meant by responsible conservatism, right? They're able to sanitize the extremist views of much of the sort of right-wing voting base for liberal consumption, for elite liberal consumption. So the issue with the Lincoln Project is that it's unclear exactly who they represent as a constituency. I mean, we're talking about a relatively small number of people who are, you know, among voters who are sort of committed Lincoln Project conservative Republicans. And the other aspect of this, and I think this is especially true just in light of what we've seen with the campus protests that have been roiling the country over the past, certainly have intensified over the past week, is that there is a danger in when you allow quote unquote, responsible conservatives who've been forced out of the Republican Party, you know, because of the hegemony of MAGAism there now. When you allow them into sort of the liberal big tent, the Democratic big tent, you run the risk of pulling the party, especially party elites, because that's how this faction has exercised its power on the right, to the right, towards, you know, center right conservatism. Which can undercut, I think, some liberal policy initiatives, and I think just also risks. And again, I think we're seeing this with the reaction of many campus administrations. Just risks dragging the cultural politics of sort of elite liberalism to the right as well. So that's the danger. I mean, I'm not saying that there aren't trade-offs. I mean, you obviously, opposing MAGAism is a necessary and worthy and absolutely paramount cause, but there are political trade-offs in sort of forging these coalitions.
So, just in closing, though, you mentioned these campus protests. Is it your sense, since you are a postdoctoral associate of the Yale program for the study of anti-Semitism, do you see it as anti-Semitism as a part of it? I mean, obviously there is elements of anti-Semitism, but there's also amongst a lot of young Americans a kind of revulsion about what's happening in Gaza.
Yeah, I mean, I will say that, I mean, this is a time I've been trying to write a sort of detailed essay on this for a while now, and I've still been drawing blanks on it because I'm up to, you know, several thousand words. There's a lot that can be said. I will say this, that yes, there is absolutely anti-Semitism on the left. It's manifested in a variety of different ways. And you know, I mean, you can see this in some of the, there was the Go Back to Poland chants outside of Columbia University last weekend. However, those elements have been relatively marginal on the campus protests themselves. I think it's revealing that a lot of the most anti-Semitic stuff that we've seen in the footage of all of this has been from people protesting outside of Columbia or off of the campus or, you know, wherever. And if you've ever been at a street action in New York, you know, on the left, you'll have the RevComs and the PSL people come out, and they can be pretty out there. And I suspect that that's where we're seeing a lot of the most extremist agitation. Certainly, my personal observations of, and I've been to many of these protests as an observer over the past 6 months, I've never actually seen anything. I mean, other than if you consider the River to the Sea chants to be definitionally anti-Semitic, which I don't. I think they're anti-Zionist, but I don't think the two are reducible to each other. I have yet to see anything personally that I thought, wow, that's anti-Semitic. And I think that the vast majority of the college students who are involved, this is just my sense, are motivated by, and I share their outrage over a real disgust for US support for what is arguably, if not a policy of genocide, then at least mass ethnic cleansing of Israel in Gaza. But it's a complicated and it's a very, I mean, you know, we could go on at length about this. I do worry that we're seeing, certainly not a repeat of 1968, but we are seeing the kind of tensions between activists protesting what they believe to be an unjust war, and I think rightly so, with a liberal establishment that seems to be more interested in suppressing these protests as opposed to actually engaging with and de-escalating them. And I think it's going to be a political problem for the rest of the year.
Well, David Austin Walsh, I thank you very much for joining us here today.
Thank you, Ian.
And again, I've been speaking with David Austin Walsh, who's a postdoctoral associate at the Yale Program for the Study of Antisemitism and a college fellow at the University of Virginia. And he's the author of the new book just out, Taking America Back, The Conservative Movement and the Far Right. This has been Background Briefing. I'm Ian Masters, and I'd like to thank producer Graham Fitzgibbon and assistant producer Evan Green to help us sustain this program into the future and ensure it remains free to all. Please take a moment to support us by going to backgroundbriefing.org/donate or publictruthmedia.org, where you will find our nonprofit Public Truth Media Foundation, where your tax-deductible donations, large and small, keep us broadcasting. And if you've missed any of today's programs or would like to explore our vast archives, you can find us at backgroundbriefing.org, where we include extended interviews searchable by topic and have made it easy for you to sign up for daily email updates that provide links to resources, articles, and books discussed on the program. Also, you can find links there to subscribe wherever you get your podcast, and we encourage your ratings and reviews on these platforms. Find us on Twitter and Facebook at Ian Masters Media. And please do help us reach more listeners by sharing this program with friends, family, and colleagues. And I'll be back again on Sunday with another Background Briefing. Bye for now.
The guy that lived next door in 305 took the kids to the park and disappeared by 9:30. Who will ever know how much she loved them so? That dark night alone. One more light goes on.